Now, for the United States, this is where we're located. These are our closest military facilities. If you visit many of them, you'll see that they are not nearly as well fortified as Taiwan's military facilities. But frankly, none of our forward operating bases, whether they're Taiwanese or American or others, are sufficiently hardened and resilient for attack. Because as democracies, we tend to take peace for granted. And this is true of any democracy. Any time in modern history that democracies at peace take peace for granted, that we do get complacent. We don't spend enough on defense. We don't invest enough in it. We don't prepare sufficiently for it. And this is true not just of the United States and Taiwan, but also of Japan, as General Gregson was describing, also for South Korea, also for our European NATO allies. Unfortunately, it's not true for the bad guys. Our adversaries, our rivals, authoritarian governments, they don't have to answer to a critical media. They don't have to answer to another political party that is going to criticize them if they spend too much of the citizens' money on military. They don't have to answer to Congress or to Parliament. And so they can spend as much as they want. And they can build up, as Rick Fisher was saying, as fast as they can for these missions, which their leaders deem vital for their own security and survival. Now, I included this graphic, and it makes up the cover of the book, primarily because I noticed that most books that talk about defense and security issues in Taiwan always have a picture of a F-16 taking off, or a ship in the Taiwan Strait. It seems very anodyne. It seems kind of antiseptic. Because that, I mean, air war, you can't really see it, right? You're talking about guys up at 30,000 feet, well beyond the horizon. Same with a naval fight. That happens over the horizon. You don't see it. You don't watch people drown. You can't hear the deaths. But when you're talking about invasion, an invasion and occupation of a country that is heavily urbanized, 23 million people, when you're talking about that particular scenario, you're talking about a knife fight. Ultimately, you're talking about people fighting in the streets. Because again, you can go to Taiwan, you can look at the invasion beaches, and you can see how close they are to heavily, heavily urbanized areas. And you can talk to Taiwanese military officers and our Marine attaché, our Army attaché in Taipei, and you can talk about how the war games play out and how things look to them and what are the preparations. And this is a fight that would take place right in the middle of cities. And the question becomes, for some of these operational commanders, how do you get the civilians out of the war zone fast enough to then deploy your own troops when you're under fire, when Taiwan cities are being hit with missiles and drones, right? These are very difficult questions. And that's why it's so important that we do, as a community of students and scholars, academics, and policymakers, and military officers, and intelligence professionals, that we as a community of Americans, that we're constantly assessing and reassessing, how does Taiwan's national defense and security stack up? How does the picture look? And what can our country do to help deter the Chinese from ever seriously contemplating carrying out these war plans which they've developed, and which they've invested a tremendous amount of time and energy and material resources into? And of course, we're now seeing China become this dictatorship under Xi Jinping. And we're seeing a leader in China who's so much more aggressive than any of his predecessors, certainly anyone since Mao Zedong. We're seeing a leader who is constantly threatening countries around his periphery. You can look at the past 5-6 years, you can look at his track record. I mean, if any of us apply for a credit card, how do we know what our credit score is? Well, they look at your past behavior, your past financial behavior, and then you get your score. And it's a very good indicator of your future behavior. What you've done in the past is a very good indicator. Look at Xi Jinping's credit score. Look at his relationship with every country. Certainly all the democracies are on his periphery. Look at all of his threatening bellicose language on Taiwan, as Bonnie Glaser talked about earlier today. It is remarkable. And then you dig into the PLA literature. Look at the way PLA officers are trained to think about Taiwan. And it's very sobering. And so we as a nation, we need to spend a lot more time thinking about what we can do to help rewrite this balance, which is tipping fast away from us, that we can secure the status quo. What is the status quo? The status quo is a democratic, free, and open world order that we built at great price, not we, certainly not anybody at this table, but our grandfathers, mostly, built at great price in World War II, and then fought through the Cold War to keep that potential great war from ever turning into a catastrophe. And we need to make sure that this never actually happens, that this just continues to be something that we talk about at academic conferences and that military officers think about and war game out, but it never actually occurs. And I would submit that if you look at our track record over the past 10 years, the U.S. government is not doing enough. Our country has not done enough. That we have time and time shied away from doing the hard thing under pressure from China. And we need to get much more serious about this. We need to stop being so complacent about this. And so if this research does anything, I hope it's that. I hope it wakes Americans up to this very real threat from China. And I hope it also, as David Ahn was talking about, it also helps inform a more nuanced discussion. Because again, the Chinese propaganda line is Taiwan is it's a lost cause. It's inevitable that China is going to conquer Taiwan. Just look at the size disparity on the map. Look at the economic disparity. Look at the defense spending disparity between the two. How does Taiwan, with its 170,000 man military, how could they possibly compete with a 2 million man military in China? And so I think it's very important to look at it with a lot more nuance and to look at a lot of the details which exist. For example, the Taiwan Strait itself, the local terrain, the equipment, the timing factors, the intelligence factors, and to look at it all and then to ask the question of, is Taiwan defensible? I would argue that it's very defensible, but are we doing enough? I think the answer to that question is no. And we can talk a little bit more about some of the things that we might consider doing during the Q&A. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian, for taking us from a big picture strategy to almost to the door of the situation room. So thank you. All right, I think we've had some compelling presentations and before I open it up to the audience, who have been waiting patiently, let me just ask a question to a directive probably at Ian and David Ahn, and then I have a short one for David Kidder as well. But the first thing that I want to ask you is, can you talk about the U.S.-Taiwan strategic perceptions and threat perceptions? How linked have they really been over time in recent years? Because now you look at the national security strategy of the United States, which sees clearly China as a revisionist power. Well, earlier it was all about engaging China. But at different points in time, I can remember Taiwan's and the United States' threat perceptions diverging. So to what extent do you see any consistency really, or are we going to have to live with much more ad hocism despite what IR theory might tell us or more objective factors might tell us one way or the other? So let me open that up to either David or to Ian.
Sure, thank you, Deepa. So yeah, that's an excellent question about threat perceptions Taiwan toward China and also the United States toward China and whether or not they're aligned or they diverge if the U.S. thinks more threatening and Taiwan doesn't or vice versa. So looking back at the past 8 years before the Trump administration, when I was back in government at the State Department, during the Obama administration, the U.S. policy toward China, U.S. policy toward China was very simple. It was positive, cooperative, and comprehensive. So that made the relationship just over those 8 years just exactly those words, right? And as we go into the Trump administration, the question is always, what is Trump's policy toward China, or what is Trump's strategy toward Asia? I can tell you what it's not. It's not the continuation of the previous policy of positive, cooperative, and comprehensive. So we're seeing that the U.S.-China relationship is taking a turn away from the previous period, and also the cross-strait relationship with the cross-strait freeze. So I'm actually writing a paper right now on this, the quote-unquote strategic triangle between the U.S., China, and Taiwan. And there's a scholar at UC Berkeley, Professor Lowell Dittmer, that wrote an article about this in 1981, and he just published a book 2 months ago on U.S.-China, I think Soviet Union, like strategic triangles in general. Based on his conceptions, we're moving away from just a year or two ago, over the past 8 years, where there were strong cross-strait relations, positive, and strong China-Taiwan relations, and strong Taiwan-China, Taiwan-U.S. relations. Strong all around. So we're moving away from a triangle that was just very positive all throughout, toward a triangle where there's tension and more negativity on the China-US and the Taiwan-China, but strong Taiwan-US. So what Dittmer calls that is that he calls it where you have a bond between two and you're like, us against the world. He calls that a quote-unquote stable marriage. So when you take that concept, you're seeing that we're moving into a new phase of a strategic triangle with Taiwan involved. So that's what we're seeing right now, is that in the previous phase, yes, I would say if you look at the Ma Ying-jeou policies toward China, the vibrant Seth Arath channel, Steering Foundation, Association for Relations Across Taiwan Strait, a lot of vibrant discussions there, and U.S. cooperation with China, you had that three-way cooperation. Moving away from that, though, towards the quote-unquote stable marriage, where U.S. and Taiwan is strong, but us against the world, us against China.
Okay, thank you. Ian, do you have anything to add?
Sure. So I just got back from Taiwan. I was there just a week ago. I got back. And I was struck by this combination of really pessimism, that morale seemed to be low. And that struck me because the U.S. Congress had just passed the Taiwan Travel Act, which is incredible. It is probably the most important thing that the United States government has done in its relationship with Taiwan since 1979 and the Taiwan Relations Act, because it does have force of law. And while Chinese diplomats may argue to you, and some American scholars may argue, that this is just the sense of Congress, the reality is this is the will of the American people. When you have every member vote yes in the House and in the Senate, this is the will of the American people. And it does have force of law. And then we immediately start to see Washington send high-level officials to Taiwan. We see, for example, Alex Wong making a public appearance with President Tsai, calling her President Tsai, really pushing the envelope. When we see folks talking about how we may mark the establishment of our new de facto embassy. So AIT is it's an embassy in all but name in Taipei, and we're moving from the old facility, which was built in the 1950s and it's really gotten run down over time, to a brand new, very large, cutting edge facility in Taipei. And when they cut the ribbon on that this summer, it's expected that high level American officials will attend that event. It's expected that we will move a squad of Marines to have them there for embassy security. We've not had that in Taiwan. There's also speculation that they may appear in uniform, which would be real, very real progress. So there's a lot that is going on that I assume wrongly as it turns out, would have bolstered morale in Taiwan. But I think that most Taiwanese observers are very sophisticated, and they look at what Xi Jinping has done since the 19th Party Congress. They look at the direction that he's gone in. They look at China's massive military buildup across from them. They look at the bomber flights that are encircling the island. They look at the naval movements around Taiwan. They look at the unilateral declaration of the M503 flight line, which goes right up against the center line and allows the Chinese to potentially engage in sneak attacks on Taiwan's outer islands. They look at all these developments, and then they look at President Trump, and they just are a little shaken by this fear, and I think it's a fear that is stoked in part by our president's behavior, but even more so perhaps by Chinese political warfare. This is the media influence that the Chinese have in Taiwan. This is the influence the Chinese have over academics, many academics in Taiwan, who sow the seeds of doubt in everybody's minds. And they're very, very good at this. Nobody knows how good the PLA is at combat. We're lucky we don't know, right? Because we haven't seen China fight a major war in a very, very long time. But I think it's clear that they're very good at intelligence, and they're very good at psychological warfare. They're very good at getting into people's heads and minds, not just in Taiwan, also around the world. But Taiwan, of course, is central front for them. And I was struck by that sense of insecurity, and I think that this sense of insecurity in Taiwan is building, and it's going to get worse unless the United States, I'd like to say the United States and other countries, but there are no other countries. The only country that really matters on this is the United States. Nobody else is coming to the rescue, especially if the United States doesn't. You know, it'd be nice to pass the buck to Japan or to Australia or to India, but the fact of the matter is the United States is the player that matters here. If the United States doesn't move on this, nobody else is going to have the guts to. And so it's essential that we start to do a lot more to bolster morale in Taiwan, to make people there feel like we have their back, and to show that we have the resolve to actually carry out our national security strategy.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to restrain myself and not ask another question. Instead, what I'm going to do is open it up, and since we don't have a whole lot of time, I'm thinking that I'm going to collect a few questions, and then if I'd ask you to please keep your questions brief and make it a question, and also we'll keep the answers brief as well, if you can do both. So let's, and I know there are many students here, so I would like to give them an opportunity if they have questions to start off with. So, all right, and please identify yourself when you.
Hi, Steve Gaines, first year student here at the LA School. Two questions.
You look too professional. I thought you were.
It came from
came straight from the State Department.
Actually, that's true.
Okay.
For anyone who wants to take it, two questions. First was the energy crisis, how on pace it. So I don't have the most recent data, but at least December last year, U.S. was still the highest producer of natural gas. Is that in the Tsai administration's, you know, view, and is the Taiwan lobby here in Washington focused on that as a potential solution to their energy problem and importing U.S. natural gas? Second question is, how closely is Taiwan following the events of the Korean Peninsula? Are they worried about that? And since that, you know, the last Korean War really put them in between U.S.-Chinese crosshairs, and I guess maybe just a follow-up question is, are there in China's strategic calculus for Taiwan, there are little linkages between the peninsula and Taiwanese security? Those are my two questions.
Okay, thank you. Any other students? Okay, in the back.
Hi, I'm Hank Kang, Junior Studying Agent Studies in Chinese. I just have a question for Mr. Easton. In your presentation, you mentioned the Taiwanese possessions such as Kunming and Guangdong, their value in monitoring the land force of the mainland and lead up to invasion. In your opinion, is there potential for a limited conflict between Taiwan and China? Should China attempt to seize these islands? And if so, does Taiwan have any good options regarding defending its territories outside the island of Taiwan itself? Thank you.
Okay, non-students. Anybody else? Yes.
Yeah. I am Gary Fenerys. I was a student here, not in the Netherlands. I have a question on the point that was touched on by all three in your excellent presentations, and that's the fact that China is taking advantage of the fact that Taiwan has a free and open society. It's trying to undermine the democracy by disinformation and rumor campaigns that are actually much more intensive than what Russia ever tried to do here in this country. There was a talk on Formosa television just the other night on Chen Tingkang, and they basically had just dozens and dozens of examples how China is doing that. So my question is, what else can Taiwan to do to counter that kind of soft undermining of its democracy?
All right, thank you. Any others? Because we only have about 6 minutes, so I want to make sure. Okay, how do we want to, who wants to go first? David? David on?
Sure. In terms of Taiwan's energy situation, I'm not sure. Specifically what's going on with U.S. natural gas, but I would say that it's not going to help Taiwan if China had any sort of blockade or any sort of interdiction of energy coming to Taiwan. To me, and this is not the choice of the Taiwanese people at the moment, the real answer was nuclear security, nuclear energy, I should say. Now, can the U.S., if there was some conflict, also protect convoys of U.S. natural gas going to Taiwan? That's real speculation, but I'm not sure how that would play out. So.
David?
Sure. Thank you, David, for addressing the energy security piece. I could address the Korea Peninsula situation and also the Garrett's question about the free open society and how that leaves Taiwan and the U.S., other democracies, more vulnerable. So for the Korean Peninsula, I've also written about this in the Global Taiwan Brief articles, that this is an opportunity for Taiwan to play a greater role within U.S. efforts and Japan and South Korea's efforts, because the same threats of nuclear weapons from North Korea and also missiles, the delivery vehicles, they could fly over Japan and then potentially fly and hit Guam, then that means that Taiwan's also within range. So, but I wrote an article about this where you don't really hear as much about this within Taiwan's news or within Taiwan's government. So just to speculate, perhaps if you keep your head low, then North Korea doesn't really then target you. So that might be just to speculate. Maybe that's a reason to really not deal with this because then you're not a target. But if Taiwan, if this were to translate into Taiwan's military capabilities, then what would make sense is that Taiwan currently possesses PAC-3 Patriot Advanced Capability missiles, but those are not the long-range interceptor missiles. So these are not, you know, surface-to-surface missiles. These are interceptor, surface-to-air, designed to only just hit other incoming missiles, especially nuclear tip, long-range ICBMs. So what this would mean if Taiwan is more under this North Korea long-range missile threat is perhaps having layers of defense beyond this shorter-range PAC-3 into the direction of what Japan has in SM-3, part of Aegis, Standard Missile 3 that Rick Fisher mentioned earlier, because that has exo-atmospheric capabilities. It's not just shorter-range, it really pushes out so that you have more shots at the incoming bogey so that you're less vulnerable. Or the THAAD missile system as well. The difference is SM-3 is mostly sea-based, although there's now Aegis ashore, and then that is low-level trucks. So that's how it might impact Taiwan toward a direction of having a layered defense, such as that or SM-3. For free and open society, that's definitely what happens when there's freedoms, right? Is that then others can take advantage of that, especially if they have a closed society. Like, China can come over here and set up newspapers and media and have all this influence and Confucius Institutes, while China and Russia, you know, they don't offer that same kind of reciprocity toward other countries. So this is where, the simple solution for this is to have a more educated public to differentiate between fake news and real news, alternative facts and facts, I guess. So, but beyond that, there may be other institutional ways or more government policy ways to deal with that as well.
And then regarding the question about Taiwan's outer islands, Jinmen, Manzhou, Dongyi, Wuchouyu, these are remarkably well defended. Not in terms of numbers of troops that are out there. This is not the 1950s or 60s anymore, where you have tens of thousands of, hundreds of thousands of troops right off the Chinese coast. There's probably now only about 5,000 guys out there, but these 10 spread out along these island citadels, and that's what they are. They're fortresses. They have been bunkered into since the early 1950s, and they're solid granite. You look at the second Taiwan Strait crisis, 1950 August, when in the first wave of attack, the Chinese fired 40,000 shells at Jinmen and did remarkably little damage because everything was under that rock. They're very well fortified. The units that are out there, there's a lot of Marines out there, there's a lot of Army Special Forces and Frogmen out there, and there's a lot of advanced artillery out there. So these are crack outfits that are out there, and they put up a hell of a fight if they were attacked. There's also multiple launch rocket systems that are out there and a number of other advanced capabilities. And so they could do a lot of damage to some of China's amphibious invasion staging areas. But ultimately, there's no question they would be overwhelmed. They would be cut off, they'd be isolated, their stocks would run out. They'd run out of food and water after somewhere between 30 and 60 days, depending on the island. And on what got destroyed in bombardment or what got destroyed by saboteurs. So eventually they would be overwhelmed. But they could put up quite a fight and make quite an impact on the PLA as they did that. And of course, what they ultimately provide the defenders of the Penghu's in Taiwan proper is really strategic depth, because they are that tripwire that's out there. They give time, they slow down the PLA, and they give time for the rest of the country to mobilize and to get ready. Because you have to assume that if the Chinese engage in a full-scale invasion of all the outer islands, then the Penghu's and Taiwan proper would be coming next. But of course, as you pointed out, it's also possible that the Chinese could engage in a limited conflict and just take one or two of the islands. That's entirely possible as well. And it's remarkable the attention that the PLA has paid to these islands. If you go through any of the field manuals, Chinese Special Forces field manual, their Army Aviation, their Joint Capabilities field manuals, Army, immense amount of research and preparation has gone on the Chinese side for attacking those outer islands. And of course, on the Taiwanese side as well. You talk to folks in the Taiwan Marine Corps or their army, guys that have served out there, they're very proud of their preparations to defend those islands and to make sure that they would play their part in the defense of their homeland.
All right, thank you very much. The hour is late, but we're actually going to end on time. And I must say that I think this panel has done a remarkable job of looking at sort of grand strategy down to the nuts and bolts. And I think they've been a tremendous complement to the earlier panel that looked at US-Taiwan relations and the broader strategic scenario. So I think you've seen these three young gentlemen who clearly are going to be rising stars in the Taiwan studies and China across trade relations. So keep an eye out for them, and please join me. And thank you all for coming and staying until 7 p.m. So please join me in thanking the panelists.